Hello and welcome to Talking Shit About, a monthly podcast where I, Elizabeth Whipperman, interview someone about something they love, something they hate, something they've been through, or something they just know a lot about, and hopefully by the end we've all learned something. This is a great interview, and I feel that it's very timely because it has a lot of tips about organizing, which right now is a very good time to do. Before we jump into the episode, just a reminder that my merch shop is open, the sale is over, but there's still lots of cool items for you to purchase should you choose. I have another design added since I last spoke with you. It is an Abolish ICE design. All of that money goes, like the NIMBY Bingo designs, to Tillamook County Food Banks. So consider buying some of that so we can get people in Tillamook County fed. And without any further ado, let's go ahead and talk some shit.
And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? I have friends that are firefighters, and I know that they use soap.
And she was screaming at me over soup.
Fuck this, I am not ever talking to a Scientologist again. These people are all insane.
I'm putting my bricks in the dumpsters, motherfuckers. Do you see me, bitches? I'm throwing my bricks. And he's just like chucking.
Hello, everybody. We're here with Deepti, and we're going to be talking about the internet and activism and how that all kind of ties together. Deepti, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm really excited for this conversation. So I'm just going to let you kind of introduce yourself and how you kind of tie into this topic.
Yeah, so I'm a writer, artist, and engineer. And lately, a climate activist. So yeah, this is something I've been very interested in. I kind of bounce around and do a whole bunch of different stuff. I'm not very good at explaining myself.
And when you say environmental activism, is there anything like specific with that or just all of the things that we've got going on?
Yeah, well, I've gotten involved in kind of local activism. So basically, I joined the local chapters of a bunch of environmental groups. The big ones for me were 350 and the League of Women Voters, but I have a couple others. And basically, we have issues that come up and become the priority of the organization, and so those end up being the issues that we take some action on.
And have you always been? I'm trying to think of the phrasing for this. Like activist minded, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I think I was very interested in climate and environment because I really liked animals and I watched a lot of nature documentaries. And I kind of grew up thinking, okay, this is a big problem, but it's interesting and I want to get involved in solving it somehow. But I think I was looking at it more from kind of a green technology and kind of trying to invent the thing that was going to solve everything point of view. And I came to activism as kind of the main activity that, you know, kind of moves the needle on these issues around 2020 or so. You know, it was kind of a rough time for everybody. And I was doing a lot of thinking. And I went on a research deep dive and came out saying, okay, so, you know, all of these other things are fine, but the real point of action is when you can kind of convince people. And so I started joining organizations that do that sort of thing.
And then, so you mentioned growing up with nature documentaries and stuff. Did you grow up with the internet?
Sort of, yeah. I was a very slow adopter of the internet. So when I was around 10 or 9, I think that's when I started using the internet. Before that, I just used the computer. You know, we had a family computer, mm-hmm. and I'd play games on it. You know, probably very educational. Nerdy stuff. And I gradually became exposed to the internet over my teens. But there's a lot of stuff that existed back then that I just didn't use until quite recently.
And what are some of those things?
Yeah, so I was for example, Reddit has been around since 2005, but I think I adopted it in the last couple of years. Most social media I was just not very interested in. I primarily looked at blogs. I looked at like fandom blogs or blogs about, I don't know, working out or something. And I would go to like specific websites. Like, I used to go on the Wikipedia front page and read it. So I'd had like a circulation of things. I'd be like, okay, let's go on the internet. Let's visit my, you know, 5 websites. And I still sort of work like that. But I was a very slow adopter for Facebook. Like, all my friends were on it. And I joined very late. I barely used it. And then I deleted it last year in a sort of symbolic gesture. And
it's probably a good call, honestly.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. And I think Tumblr, I would have really enjoyed Tumblr if I'd known about it, or, you know, if it had been on my radar. But I think I discovered that in the last 5 years or so.
Yeah, I love Tumblr. I used it a lot in like middle school, high school. And yeah, it's definitely not the same as it was back in its heyday.
I've heard it's calmed down, right? It used to have a lot of drama on it.
Yeah, a lot of fandom drama. I can't even begin to describe the amount of like disagreements and fights I got into on Tumblr about stuff that really doesn't matter. One thing that I was happy about with like my experience with Tumblr is it really opened my eyes to like different experiences and like perspectives and stuff. Like, I think that's how I really got familiar with a lot of like LGBTQ issues and language and stuff like that. So I'm grateful for that. But how did your internet experience kind of tie into your desire for change and wanting action?
Yeah. So, I mean, in one way, it was really helpful because when I decided I was going to inform myself on all the issues, I had easy access to important official reports and a variety of articles. And it was, you know, very helpful to go, you know, the entire depth of the internet. Like, you could read tweets about it, or you could read like a 100-page report about it. And I kind of did a sampling of all of them. Increasingly, I feel like too much information is basically not information anymore. Like, information is not measured by the barrel or something. It's like, oh, I got 2 barrels of the best information. So I think a lot of people are now having to dig through too much stuff to find out anything. And when I'm trying to reach people, when I'm trying to message something or, you know, help amplify a campaign, it's what are the people I'm trying to reach doing in the seconds before I reach them? And it could be a variety of things. They could be searching the internet for information, or they could be reading their favorite blog, like I used to do. And, you know, maybe the blog has that information on it. But really often people are scrolling. And if you're trying to reach people when they're scrolling, there's a very specific calculation you have to do, because you need to catch their attention but not jar them too much with something depressing when they were, you know, just looking at curtains or, you know, something enjoyable. And you need to say, okay, are they going to stop scrolling, and are they going to open a different tab or open their browser if they're in the app and go and do something that you want them to do? And can you be motivating enough for someone to do something like that? Or do you need to do something very simple and say, hey, just remember this issue? And then you kind of message them again and again and again. So I think, what are people doing on the internet when you're trying to reach them? Because the internet is a good way to reach them, or a very scalable way to reach them. But I spent a lot of time thinking, like, okay, but what were they doing right before this? And what can I reasonably ask them to do as a result?
Do you find that you have, I don't know how you measure like success in that way, I guess through like clicks and stuff like that, but have you been like having success with getting people to like follow through with information?
Yeah, well, not me personally, because I think I'm still pretty bad at it. But in all the organizations I work with, whenever they have a campaign where they want you to call your representative or something like that, there's a kind of a sequence of kind of branches they shake to get action. So they'll kind of reach out to their network. They'll have all their kind of partner organizations or kind of collaborating organizations send emails out. And then they'll make a nice graphic that does all the things I was saying, like it catches attention, but it looks kind of cheerful. And it says clearly, please do this. And then they'll share that on all the different social media. And I believe that does make some difference. Like it does put us over the edge sometimes.
Yeah. Have you heard the term compassion fatigue?
Yes.
Do you have like a definition you could kind of share with us?
So I'm not sure if I know the official definition, but I believe it's kind of symptomatic of the issue where there are so many problems, where we have so much awareness of suffering all over the world, and we can't do much about many of them. And so we kind of don't know how to process it. We're kind of filtering it out because it's like, I can't be sad about one more person suffering or one more animal suffering. Does that fit with your understanding of it?
Yeah, I didn't really have, I don't know if there's like an actual like definition, but it just came to mind while you were talking. Have you ever experienced that?
I think, yes. I think I experience it more as like overwhelm when I'm wanting to do all these things and wanting to contribute to solving problems, but maybe I've got too much going on in my own life, or I'm not able to do as much as I want to. And then I go like, I can't today. it's too upsetting. And so I will, zone out or do something else. But also I've kind of decided that my primary issue is climate. And so when other serious things come up, I do what I consider like a regular citizen's contribution. Like if somebody wants me to sign their petition, or do any of the things that they would put a social media post out about, I will do that, but I don't consider it my primary issue. So I don't beat myself up for not being as participatory in that as I am for climate, because I've kind of decided, like, these are interlocking issues. I come at it from this angle. And if I'm in the right place, right time to help some other campaign, I will. But I don't push myself to be on every issue in the same way.
I think that's smart. I kind of already know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyways. Do you, like, whether it's personally or with your organizations, have to deal with like a lot of misinformation and combating that?
Yeah, of course. and I think there's like layers and layers of it. And it's even in the movement, I feel like. I wrote an article about this a while ago, which I can send you if you like to link. But a lot of how we talk about climate action is shaped by a sort of mainstream narrative that is from essentially like propagandists, from corporations. We kind of talk about individual action, and we talk about, you know, vote with your dollars, and you know, you're contributing to climate change by buying that cup of coffee or whatever. And that's not really an effective way to talk about it. We should be talking about it like, hey, what are the solutions, and how do we make those happen? And what can you as a person do to make that happen? I mean, we should take it as a given that our current lifestyle, what we're currently buying, and, you know, where we're going, how we're doing transportation, all of these things are not good enough. So you don't need to kind of catalog every little thing that you bought that, oh no, that company isn't as sustainable as it needs to be. Well, none of them are. So like, why are we framing it in this very minutia oriented way? So it's kind of a framing thing that I consider, if not misinformation, but like a bad framing that we're kind of stuck with and we have to keep fighting against. Like whenever I'm trying to tell someone, hey, do something, they're like, I know, but I bought a plastic bag yesterday. And I'm like, don't even think about that. Like, let's forget that and talk about stuff that'll actually work. But there is obviously like more blatant misinformation. People will argue about these like very, like I'd say esoteric, like technical things about like, hey, can we get enough energy in this area, let's say Los Angeles, from renewables? And somebody out there has put a slightly misleading report out, intentionally, I'm sure, that says renewables will never be enough or something like that. And so somebody's latched onto that headline, and then I have to go and dig through and say, where did they get this narrative? what are they talking about? What's the truth? And the truth is also in some report where somebody's done a detailed assessment of like, oh yeah, here's where we can get the energy we need. So there's that sort of thing in the circles that I, you know, frequent. I don't run into people saying climate change is a hoax because I don't have anything to say to those people. I don't, they're not really going to be able to, I mean, I'm not trying to get them onto my campaign. So we don't really have anything to talk about. We just have to sort of outcompete them. Like when they're saying that to an audience and we're saying something else to an audience, we just have to persuade more people than they do. I also kind of run into this narrative of either, you know, it's going to be fine without us doing anything, or it's going to be a disaster no matter what we do. So like both end up with, so let's not do anything, there's no point. But a kind of like doomer narrative, I think, is also a wrong framing or misinformation. This kind of thing of like, oh gosh, if we cross the 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial target, you know, we were trying to not exceed that average temperature. There's like, oh, we've exceeded it, we're doomed, everyone's going to die. So like, I consider that misinformation as well, because it doesn't change that starkly. It doesn't fall off a cliff with one fraction of a degree. But yeah, so there's a lot of misinformation, and there's some that kind of shows up more in my world, and that I have to figure out ways to talk around and past.
Yeah, I'm sure that's frustrating.
Yeah.
So kind of talking about like doomerism and like, you know, feeling guilty about every little thing, because I've definitely had those moments where I'm like, oh my God, I forgot to recycle this thing. Like the world's going to fall apart because of me. Would you be willing to talk a little bit about your TEDx talk? The climate movement needs your creativity, not your guilt.
Sure. And I think that's actually a good example of having to adapt to the internet, because I used to write these sort of dense, I guess, medium articles where I was reading up about all this stuff. I was reading about climate anxiety, and I was reading about social change and social tipping points and all these things that I was getting kind of inspired by, because these things kind of pointed to a path forward, even with all the problems we have. And I was very diligent about linking all my sources and, you know, talking people through every step of the argument and trying to be persuasive. So I'd written maybe 20 or so kind of relevant ones on Medium, which is this platform for blogging. And it was partially kind of like, you know, a personal project. I was kind of working stuff out in writing, but it really wasn't hitting the audience I was hoping it would. And it's because it had a very specific tone. It was like very interested in all the details and the minutia, which you can't expect someone to be when they first encounter a blog post by somebody they don't know. And then they start kind of going on and on about some, you know, some minute detail of something. And so I was pretty frustrated, because I was like, but this is interesting, you guys. You've got to pay attention. It's not depressing either. And so I'd written a bunch of these, and I think I came across some people talking about how TEDx talks are kind of a good way to bypass some of these algorithmic things, because TEDx will post your talk on their YouTube channel, which is pretty big. And so, you know, it's a good way to get attention. And you know, people recognize the brand. So I started applying to these. And when I finally made the talk, I had to compress and compress and compress. And I had to like make something that was a whole article into a line in my talk. And it had to have this kind of narrative flow. It had to have this kind of like emotional up and down. And so it was kind of frustrating, because I was like, I could be saying any old nonsense and you'd believe it because there's kind of an emotional punch to this, but I want to show you that it's true. Like, look at all my citations and stuff. So I kind of made peace with it by saying, okay, here's the talk. This gets the attention, and I'm going to link an annotated transcript. And then every line I'm going to link to one of the posts so that all the supporting information is there so that you can kind of fact check me, because I want everyone to fact check everything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, but that kind of shaped my thinking now, which is like, you have to encounter people. You're always introducing yourself to people. And so you have to encounter them with something kind of short and punchy, and then hopefully catch their interest and say, okay, here's a longer thing with more information that I want you to know. And then here's the longer thing with even more information. And some fraction of people are going to just go from the punchy thing to maybe taking action. Because a lot of people, you know, they operate differently. They're not, reading a bunch of citations is not what they need. They kind of need to go with like, okay, does this person seem credible? Are they speaking in a way that seems sincere? And does it fit with stuff that I have encountered before? And they say, okay, I'm convinced. I'm taking action right now. But some people that I hope exist will also read all the footnotes and things. And so I found that for me, I have to make a very detailed version just to keep myself happy and to be sure that I'm being accurate. And then I have to make less and less detailed versions for more and more people. So that's kind of become my workflow. But yeah, for the talk itself, I kind of go through my story of how I got interested in climate activism and stuff like that. And I think the big thing I'm trying to convey there is that, you know, the system can change through kind of small currents of behavior. Like, you don't need to be perfectly sustainable in your consumption habits or perfectly anything, but if you are making a small incremental change that adds up with other people's incremental change, then the system will transform, and that's what we're aiming for. But there's a lot to it. Like, the not every incremental change you make will add up with other people's things. We do a lot of stuff that we hope will lead somewhere and sort of just cancels out with the chaos of other people. So that's why you want to join a campaign. You don't want to just be trying to be perfect in your own home in isolation. You want to make changes that add up with other people's changes. And that's usually when the timing is right, when there's something in the air and everyone's like, oh my gosh, this is on our minds. We're going to do this all at once. That tends to be significant to people. Like, it catches the attention of executives or officials or whomever you're trying to affect. So you kind of need to be paying attention to what's in the air and what's building momentum, and how can we build even more momentum on this trend to push it over the finish line.
So what I'm hearing is, if people want to have more of an impact, it might be more, I guess, impactful if people organize, like, together. Is that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think especially for people who are new to it or are feeling overwhelmed, don't necessarily try to start an organization yet. Find one near you that you like, that whose messaging kind of fits with you and isn't too depressing or too happy talk, or, you know, what, anything that rubs you the wrong way. Try to find one that you can work with and ask them what they're working on and help them do that, because they've spent some time studying things and they've got their priorities based on potentially, you know, years and years of following these issues. So yeah, they need the help. So they'll tell you what to do. You don't have to figure it out on your own.
Yeah, looking for groups that, you know, have similar values and are making the changes that you want to see. Are there any kind of, like, red flags that people should look out for when they're looking to organize?
Yeah, I think a lot of these groups work with each other. So you'll want to find kind of social proof among them. Like, if this is a group that Sierra Club is partnering with, or your local Sierra Club is partnering with, and your local 350 is partnering with, then you're like, okay, these guys are probably legit. And you're going to want to read up about them, you know, on their own site, but also maybe on Charity Navigator or on Wikipedia, because sometimes industry groups are a watered down version of an issue Well, basically, I was reading up about, for example, paper, forestry certified paper. And this group popped up. I was like, hey, we care about paper, but they were basically a paper industry like self-regulation group that were trying to battle the stigma of paper because people were talking about paperless and, go electronic and don't kill a tree. And they kind of wanted to shape the narrative to say like, hey, we are making changes, but we're also the good guys. So you're going to kind of want to look out for stuff like that. Or if there's one that none of the other climate groups partner with because they're a little controversial, you may not want to go to that one for your first for your first activism experience.
So this is totally an aside, but we've
Okay.
brought up Wikipedia a few times. And I know that like in like high school and stuff, they're very much like, don't use Wikipedia as a source. I love Wikipedia as a source as an adult, or at least like, finding more information and like, looking at the notes and stuff.
Yeah, me too. I
But
think Wikipedia is great. I love the there's some sort of dynamic that has sprung up on it, right? Because somehow the correcting and the kind of reviewing system works. And that doesn't mean it's perfect, but it's operating as a system that like moves toward accuracy. And I just love that. And I love Wikipedia as a kind of starting point to, you can read it, get an overview, and then they link some stuff, and then I go read that stuff. So it's kind of a map to a new area that I can sort of dig deeper if I have to. Like if it's something casual, I'll just be like, okay, Wikipedia said it, I'm going to trust it for now.
Are there any other sites or resources that you utilize?
I like Google Scholar, or I just like searching for PDFs and reports. I have a couple of digital subscriptions to newspapers and things. I'm a little worried about some of them. I still like The Atlantic, but I used to really love The Washington Post, and I liked maybe The New York Times, but they've been somewhat captured, I guess, by the political environment. They're still kind of good, though. I'm surprised to say that the Washington Post still has some kind of measured, informative stuff. Oh, I think I checked the AP. So I think for news, I like to go, as close to the original reporting as I can for that. And then, yep, love Wikipedia. And I love kind of searching for reports and things, especially for climate stuff. A lot of articles will kind of give their take on some new report that's come out about, assessing where we are with climate, and then they'll link to the actual report. And it's usually on like the UN website or maybe a government website. So I like going and reading the original after reading the kind of editorializing, because I feel like my takeaway is often kind of different from what the article writer had. They'll kind of focus on the sensational stuff that says, scientists say that things are still getting worse, and so was deeply disappointed in such and such. It's like, okay, that's all fine, but I want to know where are things trending, what stuff is starting to work, but just needs more commitment from us, what stuff isn't working at all, or was like just a straight up bad idea. And you'll find that a lot of it, when you do the thing, like when you do the conservation, it does work. Like when you spend the time and money to restore someplace, it does kind of recover. And so, I mean, for me, that's kind of good news. It's like, okay, just double down, get people on board. There's no drastic like showstopper that came out of this report. It's just the usual bad news of like people aren't doing enough, which I don't need a newspaper article to tell me about. Wayback Machine is great. And yeah, Reddit. I like Reddit now,
Me too.
to get like opinions, I guess.
Yeah, there's plenty of those on
But
Reddit.
see, here's the thing. Reddit has this upvote system that it has its own dynamic, right? It selects for something. And I like that. You know, like Wikipedia is just people all correcting each other, but it works. And Reddit is just people, I mean, fighting and stuff, but also upvoting things that I actually want to see. So, you know, it is contentious. Oh, and Tumblr's great. I feel like whenever I've gone on Tumblr after like a big news thing, they're the ones, or at least my specific bubble within Tumblr, are the ones having the most healthy, like measured response and saying, everyone stay calm. It doesn't mean this, it does mean this. And like really academic takes on there. I'm like, wow, this is where the nice people on the internet hang out.
Yeah, I, like I said, I had a Tumblr in like middle school, high school, and then I deleted it because there was a bunch of stuff on there from middle school, high school. And then I restarted it a few years ago, and I was like reblogging a bunch of like art, and then somehow I ended up in like Nazi Tumblr. And so I was like, ooh, okay. So I like took a step back and I haven't really opened it since then. But maybe I just need to, I was like getting pictures of like, you know, artsy women or whatever. And then I was looking at the tags and it says like white. And I'm like, that's interesting. Why do you need to put like hashtag white on this picture of this woman? And then I looked at the like accounts and I was like, oh shit. So yeah, I guess I just need to rework the algorithm.
Yeah. Have you heard of this thing of like the crunchy to alt-right pipeline or something?
No.
Oh, so there's kind of this cottagecore and, you know, back to the land and, you know, natural pastoral thing that a lot of people like, but also a lot of alt-right slash Nazi accounts like. And so people, it's a thing, like what you're describing is a thing. People can unwittingly wind up there with no intention of being there at all.
Yeah. I would love to hear if you have any wins that you could share, and they can be like in your personal like campaigning and activism journey, or just like around the world or whatever comes to mind, but just like some wins for activism or climate activism specifically.
Yeah. So I think last legislative cycle, my local TWE50 chapter, TWE50.org is a climate organization. It's a kind of nondescript name. But I think TWE50 refers to the number of parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere they would like us to have. I would suggest rethinking the name if they'd asked me. But we had kind of a bunch of bills that we wanted to get passed in the local government, California state government. And we had a pretty good legislative cycle, I think, last year. This one's its own thing. And we got we meaning not just us, obviously, a huge group of people worked to get a bunch of climate corporate transparency bills where companies need to report their climate impact in various ways. Like they need to report it to shareholders. They need to report it to customers, which I think is a huge deal. Like this is very important and should have been done ages and ages ago. But the thing that was super fun was, I think it was like a Sunday afternoon, and I got an email from the group saying, so, you know, some committee is voting on this in the next hour. Please call this representative in the next half hour. And it was just exciting. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so cool. I'm in it real time. And so we called the representative, and that's always kind of nice because you get this very polite staffer at the other end. And you can tell them your thing, and then they write it down. And it's always like just this wonderful professional person that even if you disagree with their boss, they're just so nice. So we did that, and then, you know, a week or so later, we heard it passed. And I was like, I did that. I was part of that. And I think little things like that help me feel like I can do something, and the things that we do work. And these are things that are pretty high impact, like compared to, again, the plastic bag thing. Like, this is plastic bags everywhere. So I use that as an example of something that's kind of like, I use that for motivations. Like, stuff like that happens. Like, okay, I can do it again. It'll be fun again.
You may not be able to answer this question, or at least not in a lot of detail, but I'm curious, like, what you're working on or your focus is right now.
So I think we're all kind of in a new environment this year for obvious reasons with the new administration and stuff. And a lot of climate groups, but also my work, because my work is, my favorite part of my work is climate science satellites. So I'm always trying to work on that. I'm an engineer. But, you know, the whole movement is kind of refinding its footing and figuring out, okay, what tactics work now? Where should we focus now when a lot of things that we have worked toward are under attack, are being rolled back? Where do you prioritize? And I'm very interested in how to build coalitions and how to kind of build more effective partnerships within the movement. Because I think we're all kind of, these different groups are all doing these different things. And they do collaborate. You know, we share research, we kind of, we help each other out on campaigns and all of this stuff. But I'm very interested in, like, what could we really do? Like, if we made the most of all the skills that these different groups have, what if we kind of put on a campaign together that had a deeper level of cooperation? You know, what if we all work together to recruit? Because I think one of the big things is people in these groups are stretched pretty thin. We're all doing all the things. We're all helping each other. But it's this small pool of people who have gotten used to taking action that we're kind of trying to tap and tap and tap to do more and more things. But there's a huge pool of people who actually want to do stuff and want to help, but need a little bit of onboarding, need some maybe training, maybe even need awareness that, like, this is going on, that I could help with this. And it would be potentially fun, potentially impactful, and feel better than stressing out about plastic bags. So what if we kind of got together and raised awareness about us as a group? So I'm just very interested in that. We're trying some stuff out. There's a lot of talk of coalitions in the organizations I'm in. We did 2 years of kind of Earth Day events where we brought all the local groups together and gave talks and tried to recruit and network with each other and had some initiatives come out of that. But I think that's kind of the next stage in the evolution of the climate movement. We kind of have to really start working together and being effective.
And hopefully the internet can help us connect.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We hadn't talked about this beforehand, so if you don't want to, like, go there, we don't have to. But is AI playing a role in any of your activism? Or as a climate activist, do you have thoughts on AI?
Yeah, I do. I don't personally use it. I don't, not for some, you know, high-minded reason. I just don't find it particularly helpful. I don't want something talking at me. I'm doing fine without that. And I think it's kind of exacerbating the information overload, the misinformation problem, because people who write in-depth articles or, you know, do quality research are being drowned out by just this deluge of content. And they're having a harder time getting clicks because now Google will just summarize their work and not send the reader to their site. So I think it's just exacerbating a lot of the very serious problems we have with just the information environment. And so all the stuff we're doing, all the stuff we're kind of struggling against is even more so, to the extent that I'm making an effort to include non-internet stuff. Like, I try to have an in-person event for things, and I worked with someone who was putting physical signs out, and, you know, we go to tabling events, and there's kind of an increase of interest in that because I think the internet is becoming less and less enjoyable to be on. That's my perception.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. but yeah, I feel like it's just worsening a lot of stuff that's already bad, and it might jump us over to the other side where people are like, oh, okay, I finally noticed how bad this is and leads to real change. Or it might just stagnate in badness, which I would be sad about.
Well, thank you for humoring me. I did an AI interview a few years ago and it was more about like technical stuff. And I was like, oh, this sounds so neat. But now I'm like totally different. So I love to like pick people's brains about it. So thank you for humoring me.
Sure.
Was there anything else that you wanted to touch on or any other thoughts?
I think just for everybody, I think we need to start thinking about a positive vision of like, what are we trying to achieve? And it's going to feel strange to be thinking that way. And kind of, I think hope is unpleasant. I don't talk about hope a whole lot. I think for me, it's not about hope. It's about doing stuff. And if you need hope to do stuff, then, you know, get some. But I just like doing stuff. So I kind of don't need it in that same way. But I think what we do need is kind of a clear vision of what we're trying to accomplish. Like if we're saying, hey, I want to help get these bills passed, and then these corporations are all going to have to do this, and so products are going to change in this way, and that will have a positive change in the entire economy, which is small. Like all of these things are going to be small, but I think kind of thinking that through, like step by step, is important. And we spend a lot of time thinking about all the problems and like, oh gosh, there's going to be forest fires, oh man, people are going to be having heat stroke, there's gonna be migration, there's gonna be this, sorry to drop that on you, but like there's a lot of bad scenarios that are kind of likely to happen and some that are less likely. Like what if we do nothing for another 100 years? It's gonna get worse and worse and worse and worse. And I mean, that's kind of unlikely, but I think a lot of storytelling around it, like movies and stuff, like Don't Look Up or whatever, just keep wallowing in all the reasons and the ways that we don't take action or we don't take effective action. And it's like, okay, that's all fine, that we probably need that. But where's the stuff about what if we get this piece right? What if, what would we do then? And how would it look? What kind of world are you trying to get to within the possibilities that are available now? And so anyway, I think that's important. I think kind of storytelling that stuff, either just through personal narrative, like what might my life be like in 50 years? Best case, what would I like it to be like, given that all this stuff is going on? Or if it's kind of storytelling more broadly, like actual movies and stuff. I just think that's important. Maybe I'm trying to work in that I wrote a book about this. I wrote a climate fiction. It's got a more positive view. Maybe that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, good segue. Plug it. Go ahead.
Anyway, I think that's important. Like, not read my book, but also you come up with that story. Everybody.
Well, Deep, thank you so much. I will have links to everything that you would like us to share in the show notes. Did you want to share the name of your book since you're here?
Yeah. It's called Fire's Ally. And it's a young adult fantasy climate fiction.
And if do you have any suggestions for where people can start if they're like listening to this and they're like, it's time to do something. Where should I start? Do you have any thoughts for them?
Yeah, I wrote a volunteer guide, which you can link. So it's about how to get started volunteering and how to look for organizations in your area. But it's basically that, you know, look at parks, you know, like friends of some sort of park organizations near you, or look at Sierra Club, or 350 has chapters all over the place, Citizens Climate Lobby, you know, just kind of start looking at these organizations, like Google for, you know, climate organizations. Either look for them near you or just look for the national ones and see if they have a chapter near you. And I would say sign up for everyone's email list or follow them on social media if that's your preference. And just kind of have them in your awareness. When they have an event or something, go to a few, kind of shop around and then see what you like.
Well, thank you so much, Deep Dee. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much. I've enjoyed talking to you.
That is a wrap for this month's episode of Talking Shit About. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a little fun microsode. Thank you so much, Deep D, for coming on, and we'll have links to all of Deep D's stuff in the show notes. And as a reminder, once again, merch shop is open. Link to that also in the show notes. If you are not yet following Talking Shit About on your podcasting platform, please consider doing that, as well as downloading episodes when they come out and, of course, listening to them. You can also find me on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and links for all of that, again, in the show notes. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in a couple weeks.